Morning. I'm very spaced out this morning. Still jet lagged. And I'd like to thank Naveen Krishnaprabhu, who was invited me here to work with the Avanti schools, as I do every so often, and for overscheduling me. I appreciate it. I know you're listening to me. So, the first thing I'd like to say is that we're closing out the Kartik season. And the Kartik season is just a very, very special time. Yes. I'm having my confirmation here. Celestial forces. So, the Kartik season begins with the Rath Yatra, the very start of the Kartik season, and it ends with the Rath Yatra. Now, I know devotees sometimes are very hesitant to speak about the Rath Lila. And I was hesitant for the longest time to speak about the Rath Lila, until my doctoral mentor at Harvard University forced me to write about the Rath Lila. And just in case some of you don't know that quick story, I was planning to do something very much comparative between Bhakti traditions and Catholic mystical traditions. And my mentor said, I'm confident that there's plenty of research done on the Christian side. I'm not confident that there's enough done on the Vaishnava side. He was an expert on Sri Vaishnavism. He wrote a book called The Theology of Ramanuja. So this was the right person for me to study with. So he once said, so what is the ultimate vision of the Chaitanya Vaishnava tradition? He put me on the spot. What is the ultimate vision? So I'm thinking, gosh, I'm going through my head, spinning through the Gita, the Bhagavata, the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Nectar, I'm going through in rapid succession, rapid succession. And I sat back and I said, it would have to be the Rath Lila. Mahaprabhu Gauranga, delighted in that more than anything else. It is the ultimate pastime. Krishnadas Kaviraj says it is the Lila Sara, the essence of all Lilas. The Sarda Lila Chugamani, the crown jewel of all Lilas, is said by Vishwanatha Chakravarti. So he said, that's the ultimate vision. I said, well, yes, it would have to be. So, has there been any treatment of it in the academic community? I said, well, scholars talk about it, I'm sure there... He said, well, before you're sure of anything, go look. And the Harvard library system is the largest in the world, academic-wise. And I scoured the whole system, and nothing on the Rath Lila. So I came back empty-handed. He said, that is your dissertation. I said, professor, I don't think so. Echoing things I've heard, leading devotees in the room and saying, just don't read the Rath Lila. Krishna book? Chapters in there? In Krishna book. Other devotees say, you have to save this for, if you ever make it. I mean, really, very austere requirements were given. And I'm thinking while I'm sitting in front of my professor, how will I explain to my God brothers and God sisters? Oh, guess what I'm writing on for my doctoral dissertation, the Rath Lila. That's all I needed to say, right? So this was sort of terrifying for me in an internal way as well as externally. How was I to even write on such an exalted lila as this. So it was a challenging thing for me. Well, later to find out that writing on it and having it published with a very prestigious publisher, ended up putting me in a position where I could actually protect the Rasalila from academic colleagues that would have misunderstandings put forward about it. In fact, editors of journals and books knew that I was the expert on the Rasalila. Better I than some of those colleagues of mine, honestly. So then I felt, okay, I can see my purpose here. I'm like the guard for the Rasalila. Now, in Leela's that I know of, Garuda, the Garuda, is not guarding the Rasalila, but this Garuda apparently is. So that fell into place. Then I found that actually, I think we'll end fast there. But I see how beautiful these TVs are. It's wonderful. Okay, so that all that said, I found that Prabhupada's presentation of the Rasalila in Krishna book was going to be my guide when I started writing. And then I went into various commentaries of the traditional acharyas. But I found, when I finally published a kind of revision of my dissertation, I found that I was in this position to be the one to whom the academic community would go to understand the Rasalila. So apparently that was my job. Krishna had something in mind that I did not expect. So since I've been here in London, mostly it's been raining. This is to be expected. And Krishna Kanta and I, my wife, we were downtown. We took the tube. I learned how to say that. And we were looking for the Soho Temple. Okay. And this is what happened. There's Garuda. Without realizing it, I found my way to heaven. So I was lost, trying to work my cell phone, trying to find Radha Landanishwara, and we were walking around getting lost, but we finally worked out where it was. So I'm supposed to read the Chaitanya Charitamrita passage. It'll be quick, but I was going to talk about, I believe there's no purport to this verse. I think it's 251 of chapter 8. So in this chapter, we have this beautiful catechismal dialogue between Ramananda Roy and Mahaprabhu Karanda. It's beautiful. It's a dialogue that gets a little interrupted. First, it's launched by many verses for the arranging for Ramananda Roy and Mahaprabhu to come together. Thank you. It was a tiny purport. So, and then Ramananda Roy and Mahaprabhu engage in a catechism. Catechism means a dialogue that's instructive. It's a didactic dialogue. Dialogue that's meant to teach. And this is truly to me, one of the most beautiful passages in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, although it's hard to pick, honestly. Shreyo madye kun shreya jiber poi shar, sorry for my choppy bhangma, Krishna bhakta shong bina shreya nahi ar. Anyone Bengali in here? You're Bengali? How did I do? Oh, is that kind of B minus? C plus. Okay, fine. Then Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu asked, out of all auspicious and beneficial activities, which is best for the living entity? Ramananda Roy replied, the only auspicious activity is association with the devotees of Krishna. Now listen to that. The only auspicious activity is association with the devotees of Krishna. Krishna Bhakta Sangha. Right there. The only one. According to Srimad Bhagavatam 11.2.30, we are asking you to tell us what is the most perfect welfare activity. I think that in this material world, association with devotees, even if it be for a moment, is the greatest treasure house for mankind. And that's the purport. Krishna Bhakta Sangha. So I wanted to review with all of you this morning how the steps to achieve pure love of God really starts with Krishna Bhakta Sangha. But notice that's the second item on the way to attaining prema. First is Shraddha, Ado Shraddha, Tatha Sadhu Sangha. Tatha means then Sadhu Sangha. Something has to stir in the heart in order to achieve even Sadhu Sangha. So what is it that stirs in the heart? Well, I thought you'd never ask. I didn't read minds. So I compiled. Oh no, I don't do that here. Let's see, where do I do it? Okay, let's do what I did here. So first, in the beginning there is faith, or the placement of the heart. The word Shraddha morphologically splits into two, Shradd and Dha. Dha means to place, and Shradd is the heart. So it begins with the heart. Something stirs within the heart. Something that we call Shraddha, faith. So this is significant, and this is the theme I want to carry through here. From there one comes together with exalted souls, Sadhu Sangha. Now the initiatory rites are performed for offering of the heart, bhajana kriya. Then the desires for fleeting useless things cease, nartha nivritti. Then one becomes firmly situated in faith, nishtha. From there one begins to experience a divine pleasure, ruchi. Then one develops intense loving attachment, asakti. From there one develops a very deep love, bhava. And from there one awakens fully to the deepest and purest love, prema. Of the sadhakas in whom prema exists, it becomes manifest in the progression of these stages of prema. So once prema is achieved, then we have eight more steps. This is very deep stuff. I'm sorry if this is too much for Sunday morning. But this is so exquisite. I know of no other tradition in the world that delves into the nature love of God the way that Chaitanya Vaishnava school does. And even scholars who don't belong to the Chaitanya tradition have observed this. We don't have time to get into that. So next we have these eight steps. So purest love takes these forms, gradually increasing stages of intensity within prema. The first eight stages were stages cultivating the prema and arriving fully at the prema. These stages are expanding and deepening the prema. Okay? Purest love prema has its different stages, which progressively increase in intensity. Tender love in prema, sneha. Bold love in prema, mana. Affectionate love in prema, pranaya. Passionate love in prema, raga. Intensely passionate love in prema, anuraga. Very deep love in prema, bhava. And deepest and uncontainable love in prema, mahabhava. The last is only applicable to Radha, Sri Radha, and Mahaprabhu Garuda. But we taste that Mahabhava by bathing in the waters, the fountainhead of Mahaprabhu's ecstasies, being bhaktas of the Chaitanya Vaishnava tradition. We chant the Panchatattva mantra before honoring the grounds. And that's because that Mahabhava empowers us to chant the Mahamantra purely. Mahaprabhu, I've compared Mahaprabhu to a geyser. Now, honestly, I don't think I've ever seen a geyser in person, but I know about them. And we have one, I think, in Yosemite. Is it? I think it is. How my Bulgarian friends know about this? I don't know. Yeah, you know about it. Yeah, Yellowstone. Okay, it's Yellowstone. Yeah. They know my country better than I do. So in Yellowstone, there's a geyser every 15 minutes, this gushing, uncontrollable, you know, fountain of water comes out from the earth. And this really imitates Mahaprabhu's gushing, you know, episodes of prema, where he just falls apart. It's uncontainable. Sometimes his body is unrecognizable. It's because that prema cannot be contained in a body. And yet Krishna must come to experience it. So we, bhaktas, have the special privilege of not being the geyser, but we get the spray. That is the special mercy. Not everyone gets the spray of the Mahabhava. So these 16 stages of prema actually begin with Shraddha. Prabhupada says, our Krishna conscious movement is not a religious movement. It is a movement for purifying the heart. I compiled a bunch of these quotes that are, I think, quite beautiful. Prabhupada states that his mission is all about teaching persons how to love God. Actually, we are teaching the science of God. We are teaching how to develop our dormant propensity to love God. Dormant means it's already there. It's just not activated. Being parts and parcels of the Supreme, we have got an eternal affinity to love God. Unfortunately, by our contact with matter, we have practically forgotten that we are eternally related with God. Love exists inside everyone. Every living entity. You see, love is already there. In Krishna Bhakti, we grow it, we expand it, we deepen it, we perfect it. That is the beautiful tradition that we have. Therefore, Bhagavatam says that that type of religion which is executed simply to develop the dormant love. Everyone has got dormant love of God. This is natural because we are all parts and parcels of God. These are different quotes from different places. Now, this is Garuda doing some obsessive compulsive work here. The total count of instances in which love and synonymic words appear in published books of Prabhupada, letters of Prabhupada, lectures and conversations, numbers well over 62,000. Do you think Prabhupada was concerned with the topic of love? I think so. But disappointingly, I've actually heard senior devotees tell me, Prabhupada didn't talk much about love. 62,000. I'm serious. Devotees, you know, they think they disassociate devotional service from love. What is devotional service? It's attending the divine in bhaktas and everyone with love. That's what devotional service is. Somehow devotional service, there can be a disconnection. This is why I did this research. People are telling me, Prabhupada didn't really speak that much about love. These are senior, more senior than me. The word God and its permutations, such as the Supreme Krishna divinity, and phrases such as the Supreme Lord, the Supreme Person, and the Supreme Personality of Godhead, appear in at least 48,000 instances in Prabhupada's books. Now, I don't get much argument from devotees ever. Well, Prabhupada didn't talk about God much. No one has ever said that. So I don't need to tell you that. In transcribed lectures and conversations, I found over 117,000 instances. Now, mind you, this is just in the 12 short years that Prabhupada, well, 11 short years that Prabhupada, bless you, Govinda. In the 11 short years Prabhupada was here. The total count of instances of Krishna or God and synonyms in published books, lectures, and conversations and letters numbers well over 175,000 times. Prabhupada says, and our attempt is to awaken the dormant love of Krishna. Everyone has got love. The stock of love is there, but it is being misused. So when we read Adho Shraddha, we are reading about someone who's now realizing how to use love. Somehow that spark has occurred. That's why we like to hear about how I came to Krishna consciousness. The details are not so important, but they become important because it's the way that that spark was somehow fanned. That's why we like to. Well, I mean, we could sit here all day and just, we could just go through everybody. And no one story is the same. Oh, this is something I did for an academic presentation to show. I'm not going to explain all of this. I just want to. The paper was called The Scarcity and Ubiquity of Prema. On the one hand, prema is this very exalted attainment that we can arrive at after years and years of sadhana practice. Sangha, and so on. On the other hand, everyone already has prema. In the Bhagavata, I have actually identified prema being used in derivative words of the same verb root from which prema comes. I've identified, you know, dozens and dozens of instances that indicate that prema is there not only between the divine and divine personages, and not only between humans and the divine, but even between humans and humans, even between humans and animals, even between one animal and another animal, and even between a human and a cloud. Yeah, even clouds. It's ubiquitous. At the same time, the Goswamis reserve it in this full-fledged form for an extremely rarefied state of mind and heart. So there's a paradox here. But we should never forget one or the other. So this is what the scarcity model. So this is when Prabhupada says, there's no love in this world. You know, we hear Prabhupada saying this at times. There's no love. It's all bad. It's all no good. You know, it's just... Other times, Prabhupada says, love is everywhere. You heard some of those words. And that's the ubiquity model. Prema is very little, right, at the bottom of this. It's laukika, laukika kama, worldly love. But there's still prema there. Even while worldly love is going on, there is a spark of prema in everyone. I love how people are sort of creeping in and out of here. It's sort of eventful. So I claim that both should be understood together. There's a spark of prema in everyone. On the other hand, Prabhupada, and Prabhupada will say that, and on the other hand, Prabhupada will say, laukika kama, it's just all kama, lust. There's no love in this world, it's all lust. And then Prabhupada says, there's love everywhere. Now, how do you put that together? Well, I try to put it together. That's what I do here. Okay. So let's move on to the Rasa Panchakayi. After all, we are celebrating the last day of Kartik. I think actually it's tomorrow, isn't it? The full moon? Is it? Tuesday? I can't keep track of these things. All I know is it's coming to a close. Bhagavan apitaratri sharadot pullamalika vicharantu manaschakri yogamayam upashrita. This simple shloka, it's so deep. In my book, I've written over 20 pages on this one shloka. Well, I just happen to have a vision of the scenery that this verse extols. Okay, honestly, my wife put together this beautiful imagery of what's happening at the start of the Ras Lila. Even the beloved Lord, seeing those nights in autumn filled with blooming jasmine flowers, turned his mind toward love's delights, fully taking refuge in Yogamaya's elusive powers. I've scoured the whole of the Bhagavata, and nowhere is it said anywhere that Krishna takes full refuge of Yogamaya, except here. This is the one lila where Krishna completely forgets about himself and to interact with the Vrajagopikas. And you see Krishna's in the lila. Well, it looks better here on my screen, but too bad. I get to see it better. Vision of it right here. And this is where it all starts, with Krishna seeing the beauteous scene of the autumn, night-blooming jasmine flowers. This is where it all begins. We just read that verse. Then the moon, king among stars, arose, spreading soothing reddish rays over the base of the eastern horizon, dispelling the sorrow from those who looked on, as a lover caresses his beloved's blushing face, consoling her after long separation. But just as a lover touches the cheeks of the beloved, creating a blush, so the moon, when touching the horizon, creates reddish rays. What a metaphor. seeing lotus flowers bloom in the perfect circle of the moon, beaming like the face of Rama, reddish as fresh kumkuma. Seeing the forest colored by the moon's gentle rays, he began to make sweet music, melting the hearts of fair maidens with beautiful eyes. Not that any of you would be terribly sympathetic to me, but this took me years just to translate these few verses. Years. I tweaked them back and forth after reading the commentaries and contemplating these things. And finally, upon hearing that sweet music, their passion for him swelling, the young women of Vraja, whose minds were captured by Krishna, unaware of one another, ran off toward the place where their beloved was waiting, with their earrings swinging wildly. Earrings swinging wildly. Jagalokundala. Jagalokundala. I can almost hear it in onomatopoeic form. So, of course, the power of Krishna's flute is immediately presented in the Rasa Panchadayi. But several chapters earlier, in the Venu Gita, Krishna's flute is extolled. Power of it. Thus, the forest was filled with clear autumn waters and gentle breezes carrying the sweet scent of lotus flowers. Entering that scene together with cows and cowherd friends, Achyuta appeared. Among groves of flowering trees and lakes, rivers, and hills, resounding with flocks of birds and swarming, maddened bees, Madhupati arrived, accompanied by Balaram and the cowherd boys. While tending the cows, he began to play his flute. My dear brothers and sisters, this movement is all about Krishna's love call, the playing of the flute. Those of you with Gayatri Mantra initiation, the Kama Gayatri is the sound of Krishna's flute. We're being called to their divine hearts. Those young women of Raja were aroused by passion after hearing the song of his flute. Some of them, in his absence, were moved to describe the qualities of Krishna to their intimate friends. What I read in the commentary here is that the Rajagopikas were in a cyclical state of phases of samadhi focus on Krishna. So when they started talking with each other, as described here, in Krishna's absence, they were moved to describe the qualities of Krishna to their intimate friends. And they would get into such an ecstasy, they would freeze. And when they would freeze, they heard Krishna's flute in the background, which aroused them again to speak about Krishna. And then they would get so excited, so frenzied in ecstatic discussions, they would freeze again. And then they would hear Krishna's flute at a distance. This would go on and on. They just were stuck in the cycle all day until the evening when he was calling them to the forest. In the penultimate chapter of the five chapters of the Rasa Panchadayi, Krishna ends the chapter in the famous verse, "I am unable to reciprocate your faultless love for me, your own purity, and all that you have sacrificed for me, even over the lifetime of a great divinity, severing strong ties to your homes so difficult to overcome. You have lovingly worshipped me. May your reward be your own purity." And that, my friends, is the key to Krishna Bhakti. Whether we feel reciprocated or not, the reward is the purity of our love. Okay, so the last chapter, the climactic event of the Rasa Lila, occurs. I will end with this. Thus, having heard the enchanting words of their beloved Lord, the gopis forgot the agony caused by separation from him. Their desires were fulfilled simply by touching his lips. Then Govinda commenced with the play of the rasa dance with his devoted ones. Those jewel-like maidens joined together by pure love, linked their arms with one another. The festival of the rasa dance began blossoming forth with a perfect circle of the perfect turning of a circular formation of gopis who are beautifully adorned. Rasotsava sampravritta, gopi mandala manditaha. It's beautiful. Sampravritta is very significant for me because when I'm recently been translating the Yoga Sutra for publication, it's all about the vrittis, the chitta vrittis, the whole heart, the turnings within the whole heart. Vritti. Here's the perfection of the vrittis. Sampravritta. Perfect turning forth. Perfect turning forth of a circular formation of gopis. Sampravritta. This is the perfection of yogic consciousness. Explained right here, embedded in this verse. When the Supreme Lord of Yoga, Krishna himself, entered among them between each pair, and when he, with his arms, grasped the necks of all those women, young women, each thought she alone was at his side. You see, in the interest of time, you have to skip a little bit. There, glowing brilliantly among them, was the beloved Lord, son of Devaki, in a setting of golden ornaments. He appeared like a magnificent emerald. What color is an emerald? Right. What color is Krishna? So what's going on here? What's that?
Yellow plus blue.
There we go. So the two primary colors of blue and gold, or yellow, produces the secondary color of green. And notice, and it says here, in a setting of golden ornaments. So the Gopi Mandala, the Gopi Mandala, the circle of gopis, is the setting for the jewel of Krishna, who is a sapphire, Nilamani. But that sapphire appears to be a Mahamarakataha, a great or magnificent emerald. Notice it's Krishna that appears a different shade of color and not the gopis. Is their power, the love, the power of their love overwhelms Krishna. That's why. At least that's my interpretation. Okay, so we're moving here to the end of this climactic scene in the fifth chapter. Having multiplied himself in as many forms as there were cowherd women, he, the beloved Lord, even though all pleasure exists within himself, delighted in loving them within this divine play. So now I'm going to take you all to the Rasa Mandala. Are you ready? I'm sorry, the image is not so... Well, I can see it beautiful. This is a painting that I've commissioned. A very generous devotee gave me lots of money to pay Kim Waters, known as Kim Murray in the past, who was famous for the illuminations of the Bhagavad Gita, her paintings. I was right there when Prabhupada appreciated her work. And she spent 10 months painting this Rasa Mandala. According to my composition, by the way, I designed it and she executed it. You see the detail there. Sorry, some of you are so far. Can you still see? Yes? Really? Okay. This book will be a new incarnation of my original book on the Rasa Panchayayi, published by Princeton, will now be published by Oxford University Press. I understand Oxford University is a small university somewhere north of here. Said, we Harvard people, we don't really accept any other. The mandala, the circle of gopis. In the conclusion of my book, I conclude that the Maha Mantra is but the sonic replication of the Ras Mandala. No one else has said this. I admit, I've not found this anywhere. But Prabhupada just says short of this. Krishna's dancing on our tongues. Right? He has said that. You think Krishna's dancing alone on your tongue? Don't go there. That's impossible. Krishna never dances alone. Even when he's with Kaliya, right? He's dancing, you know, with gopis watching him and fainting, whatever. And he's dancing with Kaliya, in a way. Krishna's not dancing alone. He's dancing in our hearts when we chant the Maha Mantra. So this is the harvest season. It's the time to harvest our hearts. I think we have time for some questions. Is this usually the okay, we have here, and yeah, please give me your name.
I'm Jaya Govinda.
Jaya Govinda Das. That's a beautiful name. Prabhupada gave me the name of a bird. But that's, I just feel it's a beautiful name. Okay, whatever. Garuda has got its own charm.
I was interested to know if you were able to share what your professor, how he received the dissertation that he made, being given that it's the first illumination of anything about the community.
Yes. Well, they wouldn't have given me a PhD if they didn't like it. That's the way it works in the academic community. We don't like what you wrote, you don't get your doctorate. So they must have liked it on some level, but they liked it especially when I reformulated it and worked to get it published with Princeton. That's another small school in the States. And it was the first time that any devotee in the movement had published a significant work on Krishna Bhakti in the academic world. So when it came out in the book, it was very much appreciated. Yeah. In fact, I remember handing my doctoral mentor the finished book several years later, after graduating. See, when you get your doctorate, you know, you're under this illusion that, you know, hey world, here I am. I got my doctorate, right? I'm big stuff, right? Everyone just walked by and ignored me. Lots of people have doctorates. It's about what you do with it. So, in the academic world, you have to, what is the expression? Publish or perish. So I was perishing for a while, but then I published. And now I'm not perishing. Prabhupada said, the purpose of ISKCON is to write, print, and distribute books. I've heard him say that. And everything seems to be framing that, everything we do. Building temples is wonderful. I mean, look at this temple. This is one of the most beautiful temples ever, anywhere. I think we all don't take it for granted. It is an absolutely exquisite temple. I remember coming here in 73, and it didn't look like this. You were here? Yeah. You remember? It was in a It was stained glass. It was like a like a sunroom of some kind.
That's right. Yeah.
You know. So much has been done. And of course, Sita Ram Bhajwanama were not there. So there's only a lot of Lokananda. So beautiful. But the whole point of our meditation, our contemplation, our bhakti dhyana on the deities is to develop deeper vision of the Shastra and what deep messages it has for us. So, the simple answer is yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Wait, no, right here, and then we'll go here. So, we have to hand it. Oh, sorry, I'm glad. Okay. So, maybe we'll go over here first. Yeah. That's right. There we go. Well, that's a nice relay. I like this.
Thank you so much for
yeah, your name?
Coco.
I'm sorry?
Coco. I've simplified it significantly from a Chinese complicated language.
No, I want to hear the whole name.
Oh, so that would be Srimong.
Srimong.
Yeah. Prabhu King.
Yeah, we don't go for that far.
No,
yeah.
Fear lecture.
We don't go that far. Okay,
absolutely fear lecture. Yeah. It was absolutely amazing. My question is, your academic prowess by dissecting this this rasa is astoundingly astute and also clear. It presents us such an amazing picture of something that is usually not visible to the mind and to the eye. And I know that in our Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, there are so many, the masters have been great scholars, like yourself. So my question is, not having been in an academic world, but very much interested in academia, this way of using your mind, in fact, in the right sense. So what is your experience? I'm sure it's a great thing, but maybe could you elaborate on what is that specific process through this picking apart with your mind gives you, to improve your prema?
Well, in all sevas, all types of seva, we all use tools. We all have tools. The pujari has tools. The cooks, they have tools. The book distributors, they have tools. You know, maybe like, you know, wigs or whatever. I don't know. We used to use wigs in that. My wig is permanent. But tools, things that we utilize to facilitate our seva. So my tools are from the intellectual tradition of the West, but also the intellectual tradition of India. So I'll go back and utilize Mimamsa hermeneutics and the tools from the Shat Darshanas, right? Mimamsa, Purva Mimamsa, also the Uttara Mimamsa, Vedanta, also the Yoga Sutra, and Nyaya Vaisheshika, and so on. So these are tools that many indigenous traditions of India will utilize in order to further explicate their doctrine. So, on occasion, I get a kind of challenging Facebook message. You know about a Disgracebook? I'm sorry, Facebook? Facebook. I get that name wrong all the time. So, someone will say, what right do you have to write books about Krishna? Because Prabhupada says you have to be a pure devotee to write books about Krishna. So why are you writing books about Krishna? And I respond obnoxiously, how do you know I'm not a pure devotee? I mean, you don't even know me. You must be extraordinary, not just a pure devotee, but you must have extraordinary yogic powers to be able to assess me from such a distance. But then I get a little more sober. And I explained, Prabhupada read my master's thesis when I was on my way from the University of Chicago, where I was originally in the doctoral program. Satsuru forced me to send my master's thesis, which was on the Chaitanya Charitamrita, critiquing scholars' critiques of the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And Prabhupada heard my letter. I was on my way to Harvard at that point. Prabhupada heard my letter. He was reading my thesis. And he gave me extremely encouraging words that were very personal to me. And if you know Prabhupada's character and personality at all, you would know that if something I had written or something I was doing was not right, he would have cut it off right then and there. You tell this Garudadas to drop the academics. He is Mayavadi. I mean, there was that option if I had gone that way, but apparently there was nothing Mayavadic in the thesis that I wrote. Instead, it went just the opposite direction. He encouraged me. So when I get such messages on the disgrace book, I if you can guide me, Govinda, if you can guide me better than Srila Prabhupada has, I'm open. I could probably use another teacher to guide me. But unless you can guide me better than the way Prabhupada has, then, you know, I think I'll keep doing what I'm doing. But I'm open. I have to respond to your question more directly. The tools that I've honestly, I don't really like the academics. I know that sounds odd, but I love scholarship, real deep scholarship on our tradition. That's what I love. And yeah, I like dealing with the little minds in the university, my students. I consider them sort of my lab rats. I experiment. I'm writing something, for example, I put it up on the screen and say, what does this mean to you? I do this. It's like a captured audience. They can't leave. I mean, so I use them as experimental resources. So I have many blessings in my service, but one of them is to really enjoy going deep into the Sanskrit texts. And I kind of live in that world all the time. Very rewarding. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, good. Thank you. Coco.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, what's the other one?
Schwimmer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
good. Okay, let's get, while we're there, let's get another question in and we'll come back over here. Let's see.
Hare Krishna, thank you so much.
Your name?
My name is Shrikama.
Shrikama.
You were mentioning that love is dormant in all living entities.
Yes, Prabhupada said.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Prabhupada said. But it's being misused. I'm wondering, how can one misuse love? Because affairs of the heart, love is a specific feeling, emotion. How can one misuse it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I believe what Prabhupada is saying is that there is, you know, sentient beings feeling fully, the capacity to feel. And that capacity of feeling could be turned toward myself, or it could be offered to others. So, some of my friends here know this little word I've made up, So what covers the Atman is Ahankara, right? To be centered upon the self. So if that's the finest, subtlest layer to rid one himself of, what are we going toward? Once we get rid of the Ahankara, we then, the antidote for Ahankara is Anyakara. Is centeredness on another. And this word Anya is very significant. It just means other directly, but in the Shastras, it can mean divinity, it can mean another's heart, it can mean so many things. So we need to practice Anyakara. And what do we do here in this place? We're always serving another. We're serving other bhaktas. We're serving the deities. We're serving Srila Prabhupada. So it's about where we place the heart. Ado Shraddha. Where do we place our hearts? If we place our hearts for things that selfishly benefit me, that ultimately don't really benefit me, but we think it benefits ourselves sometimes, then this is misuse. But if we give to others' hearts, if we serve others' hearts, which is the meaning of bhakti, to offer one's whole heart to the heart of others, to the supreme heart, to their supreme hearts, then that is pure. That makes sense?
Yes, but in the area of where I had some, acquired some tools, it's counseling, and they say you have to love yourself in order to love others.
Yeah, that's a very popular notion. I'm having a very difficult time loving myself. You saw the picture earlier. I mean, it's peculiar, right? So I don't like this phrase, love yourself. I know it's extremely popular. You gotta love yourself, and so on. And I just keep trying, and it just doesn't work. Rather, I love others. And if our hearts can be filled up with affection for others, then that's where the joy is, not in loving ourselves. I don't know what to love. Well, what is it that I'm grateful. I'm extremely grateful for all the blessings, more blessings than I can count. We are all like that. We have so many blessings. But sometimes we forget about these blessings, like Arjuna did when he was overwhelmed. So you're a counselor, so in counseling, we sometimes go into Arjuna syndrome. You know, we become overwhelmed, we have a breakdown, and yet Krishna is right there. Now, he's a good counselor. He sat and he listened. He barely said more than three words. Now, there's a model for you. He's like the perfect counselor. He waited to hear everything from Arjuna. The shattered contents of his shattered heart. There was the misuse of love there. He became concerned with even caste and just mundane things. But really, his heart was broken because he had to kill people that he loved. In fact, he was a little angry about it, which is subtle. It came out when he used the epithet Madhusudana, meaning slayer of the demon Madhu, implying that you kill demons, but you're asking me to kill people I love. And that even you don't do. He was upset. And you know, I can understand that. So there's some good counseling there. Makes some sense.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. You there's the mic. We'll make our way back here. I don't know how much
time. Thank you.
Your name?
My name is Prayojana Das.
Prayojana Das.
Yes, yeah.
What a name.
Yeah.
Prayojana.
I've heard Prabhupada speak about loving yourself. But he was using it in a reference. He said, we can love ourselves as part and parcel of Krishna. This is how we expressed it. So in that way, because we should love in relation, but to actually dislike ourselves or even have the opposite view, is that actually we related, we said, to that we're actually parts and parcels of Krishna. So, you know, what they say, the lovers, they love even the hair of their beloved. And so, to dislike, or not even have dislike, but a regard for the self as part of the spirit soul. We should try and understand that we're part and parcel of Krishna.
Yes.
And when Mother Shikamane says about loving the self, we love it in relationship that we're all parts and parcels of Krishna. Mm. And we should love each other.
Mm. I think I'm going to modify my response to you then. That's good. That's very helpful. I never really thought of it that way.
Yeah.
That's really helpful. Yes, because we could talk about self-hatred, and that makes sense to me. In such states, people just can't stand to be themselves, and sometimes they end their lives, even sadly. But what you're saying, Prayojana Prabhu, you're saying that yes, you can love yourself in relation to that love of which you are a participant or of which you are a part. So that makes sense. Self-love then makes sense that way. So I like that. I'm learning here. Thank you. Who's maybe we come here and then we go to Paula? Oh, no, over here. Over here first.
Thank you, Dr. Pal. My name is Leela Krishna Das.
Leela Krishna Das. It's not like I'm jealous. I'm just. I even like cocoa.
So when Krishna enters into the Dasa, the name used for Krishna is Madhubani. Do you find any significance of that name?
Madhubani.
It's Balaram and Madhupati, so I know.
That's right. Madhupati. So, Madhu, sweetness, honey. It makes sense. Lord of sweetness. What, your name again is Leela?
Yeah.
Well, Leela Krishna. You should know this. Yeah. Beautiful name, yeah.
Hare Krishna, thank you so much for your class.
What's your name, Balaram?
My name is Balaram.
Oh, right. It's my old age.
Yeah. I was trying to think of this recurring theme that we have in films, music, about chasing love. And you mentioned that love is already within, and in fact, Nanda Gopa's t-shirt here says, true happiness must come from within. So I wondered,
where's that t-shirt?
This here at the back of the.
Okay, I can see it. Good.
So I was wondering, lost track of the question. I was wondering if.
You mentioned films and popular culture.
Instead of chasing love, if love is already within, and we're still looking for love, I wondered whether the best way to receive love is to give our love.
Mm. Nice. So, I like to scare my university students. I like to get them thinking about the time of death. you know, in other departments, they can study, you know, what happens when the body dies, that's in biology, or they can study about history, a lot of people dying all over the place, and they can study. Yeah, but I said, today I'd like to talk about your upcoming death. And I assured them that I've done my research that on the internet, and I keep current that mortality is still 100%. So I go in with that confidence, that knowledge. And, you know, we're all dying and going to die. We're going to leave everything that we know. And what are we going to do about that? What are we going to do about that? I mean, it's not like packing for the Far East and never seeing family again or whatever. It's like you leave this whole world. What are we going to do about that? What, you can't take anything. Not even a tiny toothbrush. It's not about how small, just like nothing, zero. So what is it that we can take with us? What are you going to ask yourself on your deathbed? I mean, at this point, they're just absolutely, you know, it's horrible. I mean, they just never knew they were going to die. Or they're living in such a way that they don't think they're going to die. But death is an important thing to address, because then you can live all the more fully. It's like taking a trip. You know, if you're going to take a very long trip far away, then it's good to start packing, you know, early. But those who have to pack at the last minute will not pack what they need. Yeah, my wife and I found that out when coming here. I mean, we forgot all kinds of stuff. Oh, did you bring this? Oh, no, I forgot. Oh, did you bring that? No, I don't have that. Can we get it here? Oh, I don't know. London doesn't have much. Anyway, so whatever. It's very unpleasant to forget things, to not pack well. So this is the challenge I put forward to university students. Those who are just barely out of the womb and they don't understand. This is going to happen. This is going to happen. And we don't even know when. If it were a rental agreement, it would be illegal. You didn't know when you were going to take up the premises. You don't know when you're going to be evicted. You don't know when you're going to leave. And you don't even know the landlord. Sorry, I don't mean to. Look, I told you I'm not feeling well. Still jet lagged, I'm spaced out. Did you hear earlier, even while I'm chanting Jai Ramana, I forget a line. I've already chanted the lines 12 times, and now I forget the line. But Jagadish already said it. No, I'm not fully there. But, so people will look to the world for love. They'll search the world for love. There's no getting around it. We're going to be focused on love. The question is, what kind of love? Giving love is only possible if you've filled your heart up with love. I believe the Krishna Bhakti process is just about that. Filling up the heart, so much so that it brims over and that we just have so much to give away. And death for a bhakta, and I've written on death for a bhakta, occurs because the body just can't contain that heart. It's just too big. It's like outgrowing shoes. You just get rid of them. So you can fit in very much more comfortable shoes. And that would be a siddha deha. I didn't read you other passages. Prabhupada says, go back to Godhead. join the rasa dance, join Krishna in his rasa dance. He says this many times in different ways. I have all these quotes. You don't have to believe me. He says, this is the perfection of life. He told John Lennon, Yoko Ono, and George in a meeting. Here in England. He said, haven't you seen? Don't you know about the rasa dance? That is supreme joy. That is what we are all looking for. Prabhupada did not hesitate to speak or invoke the vision of the rasa dance. So that is the place to search for love. But we can be understanding and compassionate. There is the search for love in all kinds of places, in all kinds of ways. So our process is to fill up our hearts, and then we, to the extent that we do, we can commensurately give that much love. So that is, I think that's our process. Anyone disagree with me? Okay, I'm good at that. For those of you who are in cyberland, no one raised their hands in disagreement. It's good. Okay, let's go. One more here. How long do you go on Sunday? I'm going to be here all day, so I don't know what you. I don't know what your schedule is, but you know. Oh, I am doing a seminar.
Yeah.
That's right. I forgot. I am doing a. What time is that?
10:30.
Was it 10:30?
Yeah.
Oh my
god.
10 o'clock. 10:30. Okay, what the heck? Go on.
Okay, I'll try and keep it short, but I guess it's kind of for me a big question.
Okay. Your name?
My name's Carolyn.
Carolyn.
Yeah. Not as fun a meaning. I think it means little woman. So not,
there you go.
Not very nice.
That applies.
You know, I'm trying to learn more about Krishna consciousness and read scriptures. And I think a part of reading scriptures is sort of, you know, hearing it, trying to play it back and try to sort of digest it by thinking it through and sometimes using your own words to summarize it and think about it, you know, in your own way. But Prabhupada talks about the dangers of mental speculation. And I've always kind of struggled to understand and like how to avoid mental speculation and not sort of take your preconceptions and read scripture through that lens, but instead try to sort of hear submissively from the scripture and sort of hear from our acharyas. How do you do that in a field which is, you know, very difficult to do that in, you know, because there's a lot of scholars use their own minds and sort of apply mental speculation. So how do you guard against that?
Okay, good. First of all, I'd like to make a distinction between mental speculation and philosophical speculation. Now, philosophical speculation is the process of anumana pramana. Anyway, I don't know how detailed we should go into this, but in the Sri Yuksha Upanishad, Prabhupada speaks about the basic pramanas or authoritative modes of cognition. So this is epistemology. If you want a fancy word, you can say, today we talked about epistemology at the temple. You can tell that to your friends. They'll be very impressed. In any case, but anumana means inference. Inferential, and sometimes it's less than that, it can be conjectural. And sometimes that's okay, even with Shastric interpretation, as long as it's based on Shastra. So work with the revelation, Shabda Pramana, and on top of that, you might use Pratyaksha Pramana, empirical, sense perception, or you may use Anumana. So Prabhupada speaks about these three primary modes of cognition in the Sri Yuksha Upanishad. So mental speculation is a little different. Mental speculation, you know, we also have that nice, so that's a real ISKCONism, mental speculation. Another one is the mental platform. And then in the old days, right, oh, I'm on the mental Remember that? On the mental. Yeah, which means I can't decide what to do. You know, should I do A? Should I do B? I'm not sure. Maybe I should do C to take care of A and B. I don't know. There's also D and E. I'm not sure how to take care of A and B. I might neglect C. If I, you know, this, I'm just giving an example, mental. I think Prabhupada, you know, his own personality and his own teaching is very incisive. Now, we're going to talk more at 10, 11, I don't know. Whatever. I don't need to know the time. At first I was upset, and now I'm fine. Just I don't want to hear the time. Anyway, the point is that we're going to speak about Prabhupada's form of discourse and some of the difficult statements he makes. How does he make them? Why might he be making them? And so on. Put these things in perspective. But in my work, my line of work, I make observations. I've made this observation that the Maha Mantra is the sonic replication of the Ras Mantra. So there's a speculation. But you put everything together, it has the power of deductive reasoning. So there is a place for this. If it's based on Shastra, on revelation, that's where it has to be grounded. So it's not as though we don't use speculation. You can't use it. You can use everything in Krishna Bhakti. But you have to begin with the scripture, with the revelation. Is that helpful? Or?
Yeah, that's
right. Is it good? Okay. Good. Okay, maybe you'll be the last one since I probably should have started my seminar 10 minutes ago or something.
I'm sorry to...
No, no, go ahead.
Yeah,
your name?
My name is Bhakta Kamita.
Bhakta Kamita?
Kamita.
Kamita.
Yeah.
Kamita. What language?
Kikuyu from Kikuyu. Africa.
Well, beautiful. Kikuyu.
Yeah.
Kikuyu.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. That's great. Okay. Yes.
So, first, I'd like to just use a... my reference, a reference to sort of confirm your speculation that.
Well, don't start using that word with me. It doesn't sound good in this context. I mean, I responded to Bhakti and Carolyn that way, but okay. Go ahead.
That the Maha Mantra is a sonic representation of the Rasa dance.
Yeah.
And the Harinam Chintamani, there's this conversation between Haridas Thakur and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Haridas Thakur is explaining that the Antaranga Shakti or the spiritual potency or these very many potencies of Krishna are manifest in many forms, and some of them are his names and his pastimes. And he also mentions that his pastimes, such as the Rasa dance, have an incarnation in this Kali Yuga as a congregational chanting of the Holy Name. So we can quite link and we can ascertain that
You're helping me. I appreciate that. No one else here is helping. So I really appreciate that.
Yes, So that's the conversation of that first point. But so the second one, the question. You say that every person, every living being has that very small, minute particle of prema, of love, you know, without and demons are living beings. So how do we deal with that? Deal with the fact that we may preach to demons and they are very atheistic and we can't really, you know, turn them into Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness is about awakening these tiny particles of love. So how do we deal with demons when trying to sort of keep this love that we talked about?
I like your accent and the way you say demon. I like that. It gives an extra oomph to the word. I like that. It's very good. Well, first of all, we need to understand about whom we're speaking here when we say a demon. We are, I mean, in the 17th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, 16th chapter, Sura Asura, right? Sura Asura. So really we're translating the word Sura, or I'm sorry, Asura, right? So Sura means godly. And Asura means, I mean, in effect, ungodly. You know, put the negative in front of it. Now, demon is a positive. Asura is a negative. So I like to translate, you know, a negative in Sanskrit with a negative in English. So, demon is a sort of strong word. Prabhupada used it, no doubt. But if you read about demons in the 16th chapter, I think you'll think of me. You know, there are a lot of qualities, assorted qualities, that honestly I relate to in the 16th chapter. I'm sorry, I'm embarrassed to say, but it's there, right? Now, the thing is this. It's all about, you know, moving from the asura, you know, arena into the sura arena to a godly. So really, they're godly people and they're ungodly people. Now, we've met people that are ungodly, but there's a lot of goodness there, right? I mean, we know this because of the trigunya, the sattvika, rajasa, tamasa. So people are varieties of these gunas. There are many good people. They just may not be godly. Demon sounds very strong, so you know, we need to be careful of our language, even with each other. Oh, I met a really nice demon. You know, it's like an oxymoron. Now, what I really feel, demon is more like rakshasa. A rakshasa, that's about as to, yeah. Rakshasa, right? That's more like just awful, horrific person who commits awful acts, harmful, destructive acts. So, there are ungodly people, and we try to bring them up to a godly level. That's one of the things we do. We just have to bring them here. They will be dazzled by just the beauteous scene here. And, of course, the wonderful persons that they meet here, like yourself. Not you. You're not wonderful. Oh, okay. Well, the others. So I think it's about that affection that we can extend to others that Balaam was talking about there. It's really about that. Giving affection, care, compassion, understanding of people's ungodly situations is purifying for us as well. They're getting purified. We're getting purified. Everyone's getting purified. Everyone's happy. But if we are in a condemning mode of others, then this is never a good thing. Sometimes I see devotees condemning one another. That's very difficult. We need to come into discussion with one another. No, we don't need to condemn. Come into discussion. So, yeah. Realize that, you know, we've got those ungodly qualities popping up, so we can be very sympathetic with those who are ungodly and not filled with godly opportunities that we have here. Is that okay? Thank you. So I think we're done, right? What are you doing with the microphone? Oh, look, okay, so we're done. Thank you so much. Hare Krishna.